I wanted to mention
that's going to be a little bit longer. The other thing that we were checking on was the homestead exemption.
Yeah, what did you find out about that?
Yeah, I pulled up the guidance from the Michigan Tax Tribunal. I also pulled up some additional material. It looks like as long as you are a co-owner, and it doesn't have to be 50-50, any co-ownership interest, you're entitled to the 18% homestead tax exemption, what's called the PRE, principal residence exemption. And a person who is the co-tenant who is living there is a person who files the affidavit with the local assessor, not the other co-tenant. So if you're a 1% interest holder and you're occupying that residence, you're the one that files the affidavit as the owner, and you're entitled to the exemption. That answer your question?
Yes.
Yeah, I couldn't find anything that said it had to be limited to 50-50 or any other substantial percentage. It was the guidance says simply any co-tenant, co-owner.
Okay, and so if the other co-owner has a primary residence somewhere else, they can claim theirs.
Yes.
I wonder
what's that?
Do you know if it has anything with the way you file your tax return?
Because you're not going to be filing with the co-tenant. Typically it might be a parent and child. The child's filing his or her own tax return, and then the parents who reside elsewhere who own their own principal residence, they're filing separately, so they're claiming on that particular property.
Okay.
Okay.
All right.
That at least is the way the guideline seems to read.
All right.
Yeah, your other question was whether or not the non-owner occupied ordinance applied, and I think you checked on that and found that I thought it does not. In other words, if you're a co-owner, even 1%, and you occupy it, then you do not have to register under the non-owner occupied ordinance. Correct.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, that answers those two questions. It's nice that we actually followed up on something, you know?
I know. I'm starting to write things down. In a specific spot. I write it down, but then it gets buried. So now it's not buried.
Hey, no problem. Okay. All right. The other thing is I had mentioned a week or so ago that a couple of things were happening with respect to the evictions. And let me give you one of them. There are two actually important things that happened that were adopted on March 28, 2021.
What type of liability? Let's stay with the ownership for one more second, if you don't mind. What type of liability does the co-owner have? So if Jackie and I own a property and she has 1% ownership in it, and she lives there. What type of liability do I have as the 99% that I don't live in the house?
Well, the general rule would be both you and Jack. Let's suppose there's a trip and fall on the property. It's not covered by insurance. So now the person who is injured, it goes after the owner of the property. Now, understand that this is a common misconception of most people, is that if something bad happens on my property, I, as the owner, am responsible. And that's not the way the law is in Michigan. The law is in Michigan that it's the person who exercises dominion and control over the property. So if Jackie owns 1% and she's living in the property, she's exercising dominion and control, and you're not exercising any dominion and control, although you might be to the extent that you've undertaken maintenance or you've got your maintenance crew doing the maintenance on it. But to the extent that if Jackie is the sole person that's exercising dominion and control, then she is the person who would be liable. But again, the liability in Michigan for trip and fall, slip and fall, things that happen on your property is very, very small. The laws in Michigan are very, very much in favor of the person who exercises dominion and control. This is a subject matter for a whole different session or sessions talking about negligence, liability for things that happen on your property. But the quick answer to your question is, to the extent that both you and Jackie exercise dominion and control, you would be jointly and severally liable. In other words, her liability isn't limited to 1%. Yours isn't limited to 99%. Somebody who is injured, if they can prove liability on your and Jackie's part, it would be joint and several. They could go after all of your assets. They could go after all of Jackie's assets to satisfy the claim.
So that's the one downfall of having joint.
Of what? No, not really. I don't consider that a downfall of joint ownership at all. The liability is the liability. You've got if you're co-owner and you transfer 1% to Jackie, for example. I mean, again, the liability is very small. You're the owner for most purposes at 99%. Most times it's going to be 50-50. You know, if it's joint tenancy, it must be 50-50, or if there are three joint tenants, one-third, 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 the percentages have to be equal. But I don't consider that as a reason not to hold property in co-ownership. And again, I just sent an email out to somebody this morning who's purchasing a rental property, and they want to know, should they form an LLC or not? And the issue is there are two ways of protecting yourself. One is to form a separate entity, typically an LLC, that would hold that property. Now, understand, as if it's an LLC that holds it, you can't get the PRE, the principal residence exemption, because it applies only to individuals. You can do it in a grantor trust, but the point here is you wouldn't form an LLC. But in a rental property, you got two ways to protect yourself. One is to form a separate entity so that if somebody's injured, all they can do is go after the asset of that entity, which would be the property, or you just get adequate insurance. And for most people, simply getting adequate insurance, if they don't have a lot of other assets, you know, when one way you can do it is a rental property, if it's husband and wife, just take title in one spouse or the other, because all of the other assets that they hold as husband and wife would not be reachable. In other words, if they own their residence as husband and wife, it's called tenancy by the entirety. And if the husband is, let's say the wife is the only one that owns the rental property and something happens, only the wife is potentially liable, and the creditor cannot go after property which is held by husband and wife as tenants by the entirety. So there are these different ways that you can protect yourself from potential liability, which, as I say, is a relatively small or slight liability. But understand, as a landlord, one of the things that you really want to pay attention to is making certain that the property is in conformity with all applicable codes and ordinances, because if it's not, and that particular defect causes an injury, now you've got a potential liability as the owner of the property. But again, typically you insure that. You know, I think what we carry is something like $1 million per person, $3 million per incident. So, you know, the insurance amount is pretty high. On the other hand, there's some people that won't carry insurance at all because they don't want to be targets. So what they do is they purchase the rental property in an entity. They get minimal insurance in order to keep the premium cost down, figuring that, hey, look, and the other thing is they may have a mortgage on the property, so the net value that's available to somebody who's injured is relatively small. And again, my point here is there are all of these different mechanisms to be able to protect yourself from liability, both as the owner of your principal residence in terms of insurance, jointly holding as tenants by the entirety, et cetera, and in holding other property as well.
So, and then one last question on this issue, and we can move on to the eviction, CDC and evicting tenants, is let's say I want to sell and Jackie doesn't, and she's got a 1% ownership. How do I avoid any conflict?
You always, always, always have a co-tenancy agreement. I don't care if you're joint tenants or tenants in common. One of the worst things you can do if you are purchasing property as with somebody else, or if you are transferring an interest to somebody else, you definitely want to have a co-tenancy agreement, a co-ownership agreement that sets forth specifically what's going to happen in the event, because it's co-tenancy, what happens if somebody dies, because the interest doesn't go to the surviving co-tenant, it goes to your heirs. So you have to have a buyout provision, and you also want a buyout or what's going to happen happen in the event that one of the co-tenants is going to sell. And the best example you gave is if you own 99% and Jackie owns 1%, that co-tenancy agreement is going to provide that you have the right at any time to buy back her 1% interest for a set fee or a fee, an amount, a price to be determined. So, but you always, always, always want a co-tenancy agreement. And it used to be that was a partnership agreement. Now it's an LLC. If you're buying the property with somebody else, you'll do an LLC. You have different membership interests. You have 99%. Jackie has 1%. And you have an operating agreement that says this is what's going to happen in the event either party wants to sell. Typically, it would be you as the 99% owner that's going to exercise dominion, that's going to exercise control over the LLC.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Hey, I want to mention one other thing on this, and I said that I haven't said this in a long time, but one of the worst things you can do is purchase an automobile as a husband and wife, is purchase it in your joint name. Same thing if it's a car that you're buying for your kid, to hold it in joint names, because Michigan liability law makes the owner of the vehicle as liable as the driver. So if the driver injures somebody with that vehicle, you as the owner are liable as well. So what you do is, as a husband, for example, you are the sole owner of the vehicle that you are the primary driver of. Same thing with a wife. What she should do is own the have the title to the car which she principally drives. If it's a car being given to a kid, again, typically you'd want to give the title to the child, assuming the child is 18 and older, so that you as the owner, you as the parent would not have liability as the owner. It's called vicarious liability of the owner of the vehicle for everything that happens if that vehicle is injures someone, other than if it's stolen.
Okay.
Okay.
All right, good information. So let's talk about the CDC regarding evicting tenants.
Okay. On March 28, 2021, the CDC issued an order extending its January 29 order halting certain residential evictions through June 30, 2021. It talks about the reasons, et cetera, but under the order, under the order, a landlord or owner of a residential property may not evict any covered person from any residential property in any state or U.S. territory where there are documented cases of COVID-19, et cetera, and that's Michigan. A covered person, in other words, now these are the people who are protected against eviction. Is any tenant, lessee, or resident who provides to the landlord a declaration of the following? One, they've used their best efforts to obtain government assistance for rent. And I'm going to tie that in here because there's another program that was just adopted that deals with that. Two, they expect to earn no more than $99,000 in calendar 2021 or earned no more than $99,000 in 2020. We're not required to report any income in 2020 or received a stimulus check. In other words, those are different categories. If you fit with any of those, then you may qualify here. Three, the tenant is unable to pay the full rent because of a substantial loss of income, reduced work hours, layoff, or extraordinary out-of-pocket medical expenses. Four, the tenant is using his or her best efforts to make timely partial payments as close to the full payment as circumstances permit, taking into account other income that they have. And guess what? This thing just blanked out on me, so I don't have the rest of it. But the point is, and then what happens is the tenant has to provide a statement to that effect. It doesn't provide for an affidavit. It's just a statement to the landlord. So if that tenant provides that statement to the landlord may not take any eviction activity. If the landlord has already started eviction activity, then what happens is the court will enter into an agreement in the court which suspends the eviction as long as the tenant qualifies or meets all of the conditions that the CDC has issued. Now, in that connection, there's something else. Let me see if I can find this one quickly. Yeah, here we go. The COVID Emergency Rental Assistance Program, CERA, C-E-R-A is the acronym, gives legal and financial help to prevent evictions and utility shutoffs for renters. Landlords and tenants can apply. This is a fund now that has been created as of March 15, 2021. Landlords and tenants can apply starting Monday, March 15, 2021. You can apply online or submit a paper application to your local. It's HARA, H-A-R-A, and that's, let me see what that acronym stands for. Forgot it. H-A-R-A stands for, I just had it up here. Hold on.
No, 115.
I'll pull it up here. I just had it in front of me. Here it is. Housing Assessment and Resource Agency. The HARA will determine who is eligible for financial help and the amount of assistance they will get. The HARA uses a formula from MSHDA to make these decisions. One, are landlords required to participate in this financing program for rent? The answer is no. A tenant can participate and get the funds, which are paid to the tenant, even if the landlord does not want to participate. However, if the landlord participates in this program, it guarantees that the landlords will get the payments. They will be quick and substantial payments for rent owed by tenants who may not otherwise be able to pay the amount due. If a landlord chooses to participate in the program, the agency will pay the landlord directly. If the landlord chooses not to participate, the assistance gets paid to the tenant. How the system works is MSHDA is using what's called area median income, AMI, to determine who is eligible. Tenants whose income is less than or equal to 50% of AMI, and this is something, Laura, this is really a terrific program if you can get the funding, if you are eligible for 12 months of rental assistance, including up to 3 months future rental assistance. Tenants whose income is 51 to 80% of AMI are eligible for 10 months of rental assistance, including up to 3 months future. And as long as a tenant's income is not more than 80% of AMI, the tenant may be eligible for up to an additional 3 months of rental assistance in the future.